Right. So hello, and thank you for joining us, joining actually particularly the MedCast series entitled Empowering Pharmacists in the Management of Patients with Urothelial Cancer. I'll probably shorten that to bladder cancer, if nobody minds. My name is Sherry Vogt. I am currently a clinical specialist pharmacist, as well as the system clinical pharmacy manager at the Hollings Cancer Center at the Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston, South Carolina. It is my pleasure, and I'm very excited to be joined today by my friend and former coworker, Megan Hinckley. She is a clinical specialist pharmacist at the James Cancer Hospital in Columbus, Ohio. So, Megan, great to see you.
Good to see you.
So today, I think we're going to talk a little bit about the role of the pharmacist in managing patients. I think we're both pretty well versed in the GU space. So this is kind of a fun disease state in my mind. I feel like this is something we've seen evolve and change just over the course of the past decade or so. So this, I think this is going to be exciting. So let's go ahead and get started. What, I guess, for those of us that maybe are not as well versed with bladder cancer, can you give us maybe talk a little bit about the background of this disease state, you know, epidemiology, maybe are there any risk factors, how would a patient present, just to kind of get us all on the same page?
Yeah. So for those that don't see this all the time, like Sherry and I might. It is actually more common than I think most realize. So it can affect about 80,000, 84,000 people a year in the United States, which ranks in the top 10. So I think that makes it kind of relevant in the grand scheme of why it's important to talk about. It is more common in men than women. So keep that in mind, just from a epidemiology standpoint. As like many of our cancers, unfortunately, smoking, or one of those things that we know, is that smoking is a big risk factor. So quitting smoking is always a big deal in these patients and with any other cancer. One of those big ones. So smoking is a well-known risk factor for bladder cancer, as well as chemical exposure. So, you know, working with different chemicals and factories and plants can also increase patients' risks of developing. And I think the other kind of unique thing to bladder cancer a little bit is more related to people who have more frequent urinary catheters placed. So that can also kind of impact development, but by and large, smoking and chemicals play a big role. A lot of times it's kind of, you know, a genitourinary cancer when we think about it. So it presents similarly to some of the other ones where there's urinary symptoms. So we got to kind of take a step back and diagnose. But a lot of times you can see people presenting with hematuria or blood in their urine, UTIs, frequent like urinary symptoms that we're going to watch for. So not necessarily unique in that sense, but still worth noting.
I guess as far as, so then if somebody is gets the diagnosis, so we've gone through all the things and they're like, oh man, you have bladder cancer. I guess, what are most people, do you think, are diagnosed with early stage disease? Are more people in the metastatic setting? You know, what does the survival look like? Is this a dire outcomes for everyone, or what's that look like?
Yeah, so it's actually better than you might think, thinking about, you know, being very common cancer, but it actually is a very treatable cancer when caught early. I think a lot of people do present with that early stage disease, so localized just in the bladder. And if it is caught early, that 5-year survival, or how long, you know, people can live while treated, is significantly higher. It's almost close to 100%, I want to say, if they're localized right in the bladder. So it's very well controlled, very well treated if caught early. The unfortunate part, and I think what we'll spend a lot of time talking about, is what happens when it metastasizes or spreads outside of the bladder. That rate drops significantly to like somewhere 5 to 10% at 5 years. So, you know, it's a very treatable cancer. That's why it's important to talk about, I think. It's a very, yeah, very treatable and can have good outcomes if we catch it early. There's not a routine screening. So this is kind of different than like your prostate cancer, breast cancer, even maybe lung cancer, if they're doing screening for that. Not as versed in how we screen for that one anymore, but it doesn't have routine screening. So I think it's something that we rely on people to report. And
okay.
See if they have symptoms, okay. I'm concerned. Yeah.
Yeah. So basically just don't blow it off. If anything's abnormal, maybe have it. It's better to be something benign than maybe, you know, something that could be something that you're ignoring, and it could be early because outcomes are so much better. No, that makes sense. That totally makes sense. Comes up, and I think from our standpoint is just, what's our role, right? What's our role in the management of these patients? I think for me, I think about, well, what don't we do for our patients? So I think, like you said, a lot of us as clinical specialists, we are embedded more in the medical oncology clinics. And so, yes, the patients we're going to be exposed to are really going to be those that probably have more advanced disease, or at a minimum have that.
Yeah. So now that we've kind of talked about, what is bladder cancer? How common is it? What do you think the role of a pharmacist is in the management of people who have bladder cancer?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I feel like when it comes to patients with cancer, what don't we do? I think we are involved in a lot of different steps along the way. I know from both where you and I are incorporated into clinic, we're definitely seeing patients that are going to be diagnosed at least with maybe muscle invasive disease. So kind of that locally advanced disease, or patients that are truly have metastatic disease, or maybe it's recurred after that initial local diagnosis. So, from that perspective, I think our role really is, thinking about, what has the patient had before? So if they did have any treatment in the earlier stage setting, what was that? When was that? How did they tolerate it? What was that timeline of things? Because I feel like that can impact, what you may introduce later. I think the other part is just, so treatment decisions in general. And so when you're thinking about the different treatment options that exist, which I think we're going to delve into a little bit more, it's thinking about, like, are you a candidate for certain drugs? So particularly the platinum drugs, cisplatin eligibility, we can talk about that in a little bit, but what does that candidacy look like? Looking at, the med list, I think we're the drug experts, right? So we're looking at, are there any, what are the comorbidities? If you're looking at that med list, it's kind of like that drug disease state conversation, can you, infer that they might have some other comorbidities that you might be worried about, and would that impact maybe your treatment decision? So having those discussions with providers. I think also, being at academic institutions and even not, does your institution have clinical trials? So it's thinking about, what trials do we have open that this patient might be eligible for, and bringing that to the forefront of the physician's mind, because sometimes more than not, it is amazing how many, times they might forget about something. And so we're in a great place to be like, oh yeah, did you remember blah, 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 blah. And they're like, oh yeah, that's a great idea. Let's bring the trial coordinator down to talk to the patient. So I think there's a huge role with actual treatment decisions, and is a patient a candidate for certain treatments? And then I think a huge role is education, right? So we are the drug experts. So, once we have come up with that treatment plan, I think we are very good place to go in and then talk to the patient about, here are the drugs you're going to receive. This is the schedule of the treatment you can expect, and really laying forth even the logistics, like, okay, you're going to come in, you're going to have to get labs drawn. We're going to wait for those results to come back. You're going to see the provider. Then we're going to go over to infusion, or maybe, the infusion scheduled for a different day. So I think it's really giving some realistic expectations to the patient as well. Just because I feel like sometimes providers will gloss over certain things, and the patient's like, oh, I just thought it was a quick shot. And you're like, no, man, that's like a 2-hour infusion minimum, so I think it's just being very realistic with the patients, from that standpoint. How many other things do we think we're involved with? What am I missing? What else? What other big things do we do? I think education is huge.
Education.
Okay.
Yeah. I think you definitely hit the nail on the head too, because sometimes, in my experience, I can do an education, and I'm also just setting the stage of what is the day like, not just, the drugs you're going to get, but also the labs that go into this, everything that goes into it. I think sometimes people do gloss over, like you said, so.
And what I think too, also, and I kind of forgot to mention, is like also not just the side effects. So you're going to list, go through those, whether if you do informed consent or not, making sure that that process is completed. But then also like maybe the timing of the side effects, like when can they expect to, and then experience certain things. And then also making sure they know who to call when. So I think every institution has a very generic sheet that says, this is how you get in hold of the provider. This is when you need to call. I don't want you blowing off XYZ side effects, because we really need to understand, what's happening and when, just so we can, optimize your treatment. And if we need to, update, pre-meds or supportive care after the treatment, et cetera. I feel like that's probably another big thing. So that being said, so as we're talking about treatment decisions, what do you think chemo, where's the role of chemo right now as a first line treatment option in patients with urothelial cancer or bladder cancer?
That's a great question. And it's changed in the over a decade since I've been doing this too.
Time flies.
It's hard to think how time flies. And I think one of the exciting things is how it's changed. So, chemotherapy If we're talking strictly the metastatic setting, that's very different than what if it's muscle invasive. So I think chemo still plays a huge role in the muscle invasive setting when patients are getting screened for neoadjuvant chemo, so before their surgery. Chemotherapy is still the mainstay. TBD if that changes in the future, but chemotherapy and specifically cisplatin-based chemo is the mainstay. So I think that's, where it still fits. The question when we talk about metastatic disease is going to be a bigger discussion, but it's kind of been the historic thing that we've used. So cisplatin, this isn't a cancer where I'm going to say, oh, I can substitute carboplatin, no big deal. That's not the case. Like if a
True.
patient is a chemo candidate, we want to make sure they're a cisplatin candidate. So,
So what makes them a candidate then? Because in your mind, if you're trying to run down that quick mental list, like what are you thinking about?
oh, there's a few things that go into it. If you want to get the formal definition of it, there are
Yeah.
criteria for it. But even just
True,
like the
fine.
mental, like when I'm doing a quick review, I'm thinking kidney function. Is it acceptable for cisplatin? The cutoff, I think, depending where you look, says a creatinine clearance of 60. You can get down in the weeds of 50 to 60 and get creative with the cisplatin dose. There is data for that.
True, true.
You can, I mean, that's one of the big things that will be my initial check to say yes or no. Are they, can they hear? Do they have any hearing issues? Because cisplatin is ototoxic, so we don't want to make that worse.
Do you guys do automatic like audiology exams?
I haven't, in my experience, done audiology exams.
Okay.
Usually, I mean, I think it's something you can tell, right? If you're
Yeah.
yelling to discuss something, if you're
The
yelling to discuss the treatment regimen,
entire
probably
floor can
not.
hear you. Okay.
Yeah.
No, that's fair.
We
That's
probably
fair.
need to take a step back if the pharmacist gets there and says, I had to yell this education. Are we sure about this? So, not necessarily, I mean, audio evals are definitely a good idea, but you can kind of eyeball test it or ear test it, hear test it. I think the other eyeball test I think is the patient fit. Like how is their performance status? So what is their fitness for chemo? Because this isn't a treatment that's just a breeze and a walk in the park. You need to make sure they can handle it. So we don't want to impact their quality of life, that they're not getting out of bed or they're not eating or, getting up, continuing their daily life. So that's a big part of it. Other things, cisplatin can be nephrotoxic, so you want to make sure you can handle fluids. So having a huge heart history, cardiac history might be tough. So kind of balancing that as well. And it kind of all goes into the picture. I think, am I forgetting anything else
Yeah.
to think about?
I don't know. Hearing, kidneys, neuropathy. I mean, I guess I might consider they have an underlying neuropathy or something. But I think that's something, whether it's underlying from different diabetic comorbidity, et cetera. So I think that might be another something I might percolate with that. Okay. I'm trying to think, what else? Where do you think cisplatin has played a role as far as outcomes with patients?
I think it's
The date, I should
definitely
say.
to date the outcomes that they've had. The data, I would say, the early studies, and this the early studies, I think were back in the 2000s, late 90s. Man, that feels a long time ago. But these studies like really validated cisplatin's role because they looked at different combinations, looking at what we call MVAC or gemcitabine cisplatin. Making the MVAC more intense by giving it more frequently with growth factor. Looking at all of that, I think the backbone of these treatments, and whenever I teach, other learners about this, cisplatin is the workhorse. As long as you can maintain that dose, that's the key part. I think the data was very strong in the beginning because it showed response rates that were improved before people, maybe the early studies weren't always about taking the bladder out in that neoadjuvant setting. We had more metastatic data to start. But you kind of moved it backwards and realized, hey, this is really good at helping shrink tumors before surgery. Now patients can have their bladders removed and ultimately be cured in the long run. So I think the data really showed the response rate improvement.
What do you think when it comes to chemo-only regimens, what are the side effects that we should be counseling patients about, or the things that we really were dose limiting, or maybe why we need to consider newer options?
Yeah, so the chemotherapy toxicities are exactly, the things that patients come in afraid of because of what they've read about, seen on TV or movies, That's the biggest, that's one of the things you start with. If it's a traditional chemo regimen, like cisplatin based, compared to the other ones we'll talk about, I worry a lot about nausea, vomiting. So, and I think that's a huge part where pharmacists play a role in patient education, you know, making sure they have the correct antiemetics to prevent nausea, making sure they have the correct supportive care at home to help prevent anything after or treat anything after the fact, knowing their resources to say, hey, I need to call because I'm not eating, I'm puking or vomiting, things that they need to know and kind of be aware of. So I think nausea, vomiting, you know, it may not be the most historic or the biggest thing that people always quote as being worried about, but I think it's the biggest thing with chemo I worry about. The next thing I do worry about is their myelosuppression. So the regimens, you know, dose dense MVAC, where we're giving chemo in a 2 week fashion, more dose dense. I worry a lot about their blood counts. I want to make sure they have appropriate growth factor support, especially in that primary prophylaxis setting, so that they're maintaining intensity. With the gemcitabine cisplatin based regimens, the risk of febrile neutropenia wasn't necessarily that high in the studies, but you want to maintain dose intensity because if we're using this in the neoadjuvant muscle invasive setting, I want to make sure that they're kind of staying on track so that they can get to surgery, have the best outcome. So, you
Yeah.
know, maintaining that as we can.
This population, like, it's not, they're not 20-year-old kids. Like, these are middle, older age men, potentially other comorbidities, questionable life choices from a social perspective, like drinking, smoking, et cetera. So, you know, I think there's probably a number of risk factors you also could consider and really justify using growth factor support, you know, if you really had a case. Or again, if they already had chemo at one point and then they're seeing it again in the metastatic setting, again, their marrow is not nearly as maybe robust as it was before. So I could see where you could justify using primary prophylaxis, but I also understand we're always in the confines of what an insurance company will pay for. So
And what the
but there could
data says.
definitely be a case. Yes.
All about the data. But I think that aside too, like we're worried about infection risk, but you also worry about, you know, red blood cells or hemoglobin. How does that look? Do they need transfusions? I mean, if that
Sure.
leads to fatigue, you can kind of correlate sometimes. Low
Sure.
platelets, you know, sometimes patients are on, if you do the med review scan and they're on an anticoagulant too, you want to be careful about that if they end up thrombocytopenic. So it's not just neutrophils that matter, it's all of the picture, but you know, I
Yeah,
think those
totally.
are the biggest.
I feel like that's something I try to tell patients about is the need for transfusions. Because I feel like that's something that's not necessarily discussed often. And usually it might just be a one line, even like, hey, we're going to watch your blood counts. We're getting your labs every time we see you. I was like watching, you know, the white count, your hemoglobin, your platelets. Sometimes if that hemoglobin gets low, you may need a transfusion. Even if it's just that quick half of a line, at least I can say, look, the words have been put out there. And so that they might know that there might be additional supportive care that might be required to get them through this regimen. And I feel like that's been helpful that way. If it is mentioned at any point, they're not like, what? You never said anything. So yeah, I feel like that's something that is beneficial definitely to warn them about as a potential option. What about like line access? Do you guys ever talk about like the need for a central line? I know a lot of these regimens, we don't have to have a central line, but is that something that's discussed, you know, as we're talking about actual chemo drugs and some of these other
Yeah.
agents?
That's a great point. Because, I mean, like you said, they don't require a central line necessarily that someone needs to have a Metaport placed or a PICC line. I think the biggest thing that I've learned over time in my practice is that as part of a multidisciplinary team, you're going to rely on the nurses who are looking at these patients and drawing their labs. And they're going to tell you, hey, this person needs to consider a central line because they're really tough to get an IV in. If this is going to be long term, especially as we talk about metastatic treatment, you know, I think it's something to consider that placing a Metaport up front may be helpful. So you're going to, I lean on, you know, the experts in that area. I'm not going to place an IV. So those that do, if they say there's a concern,
Yeah,
I
they don't
will.
want us pharmacists doing that. That's one thing I will not do as a pharmacist, is place
I will
line. No,
not do that.
that's true. That's true. And sometimes I feel like with gemcitabine, especially when we used it more, causing that phlebitis, and I mean it was real and really painful for folks, and just burned and went in. So I feel like more so that the patients were open to getting it. So they're like, I'm not going through that again, or I'm not getting poked three times just to get labs. So yeah, I feel like that's something else that's, I think, worth mentioning. Again, not mandatory, maybe not for cycle one, day one, but might be something that might be needed further in treatment. So anyways, that makes sense. Good.
Yeah. Well, why don't we move on? I think just to kind of keep
Sure.
things moving so we can talk about more
Yeah.
treatment options.
Of course, of course.
So I think this kind of segues into where we're going to head, but why do you think it was necessary to develop medications that are beyond chemo for patients who have urothelial cancers?
Yeah, no, I think it's great. Well, I mean, first of all, you said cisplatin's been our workhorse for what, like decades? We're going on 30 plus years, 40, 50, whatever. It revolutionized how we treated so many solid tumors. But for bladder cancer, especially, we're still using it. Like they up until just even a few years ago. So obviously, people are still, we haven't come up with anything better. People are still dying of metastatic disease. So we obviously need treatments that are more effective than what we're currently getting. And one thing we didn't mention when we were talking about the chemo is that usually there's a limited number of cycles you can give someone, right? Typically we're thinking 4 to 6 cycles, and then we need to stop either because of other toxicities or their marrow can't handle it. But there's a time when we need to stop that treatment. And I know for a lot of patients, the thought of stopping something's a little bit squirrely. Obviously some of our immune therapies, which I think we'll talk about in a little bit, were options in that maintenance type setting or as an adjunct or in combination, and in the possibility to continue it long term was good from their, I think, mental status as well. But I think the biggest reason we need to do more is because our survival numbers are not good. Those 5-year survival, that number plummets absolutely like exponentially once somebody does have actual metastatic disease. So I think we needed to make better improvements to get better outcomes for these patients. So along those lines, and I kind of danced around it a little bit, but what are those immunotherapies that we use in the management of these patients?
Yeah. So this is one of those cancers where I feel like immunotherapy kind of exploded in the FDA approved indications in the mid 20 teens, 2010s, 20, what do you want to call them? 2010s, roughly. Yeah. Because, like you said, like for a very long time, all bladder cancer had was platinum based therapy. And even beyond that, there were single agent chemos. There was really not a lot. And the response rates to the next line therapy was very low. So I remember when atezolizumab was approved in bladder cancer because it was one of the first immunotherapies approved. And I'm going to go off book a little because this is now no longer approved, but it was one of the first immunotherapies approved. So it was a huge deal to get response rates and sustained response rates in patients who had treatment. So I remember being very excited when that FDA approval, as with all of the immunotherapies as they came out and got approvals, but. And naturally, following that, pembrolizumab had an indication. Nivolumab has an indication by itself. Avelumab plays a role in maintenance therapy. So you kind of alluded to that part where patients can get, 4 to 6 cycles of chemotherapy, but then if they did okay, you could stop and watch, monitor, surveil. But avelumab kind of entered the stage and said, "Well, now I have a maintenance therapy option." So patients respond to chemotherapy, a doublet therapy, for example, and then for, a period of time, they can go on maintenance therapy. So you're not doing nothing. So that was a new thing in bladder cancer. There is a whole debate, and I think this kind of will move into part of the other treatments we talk about. But the immunotherapy agents got evaluated as cisplatin eligible patients, cisplatin ineligible. Could you use them right away versus did you need to wait after chemo? So I think that kind of opened the doors to show that immunotherapy is effective in urothelial cancer, all kind of evolving into more that or more options for our patients, I guess
Sure.
you could say.
So, what was the actual efficacy of some of these drugs? Like, if you had to pick, I don't know, your two favorite, or I don't know, pick, let us know.
Yeah, so it's hard. It's interesting because over time, I kind of alluded to it earlier, atezolizumab was the first to get approved. But it was one of the first to have its indication withdrawn when data wasn't as effective as we thought it was. Similarly, durvalumab had something single agent. It also lost its approval, but it's gained a new stepping stone that we haven't even talked about in bladder cancer. But saying that, I think pembrolizumab and nivolumab really play, a big role to me. I'm picking a single agent. Pembrolizumab has great efficacy data. There were phase 3 data that was effective. Not I forget the numbers off the top of my head, but I just remember the difference being we had phase 3 outcomes versus phase 2, and that plays a big difference when you're picking a treatment. Additionally, like There's a frequency schedule too that, patients can get it every 3 weeks. You do, if they do okay, span it to every 6 weeks, and that might afford them a little more time to do other
Sure.
things.
Sure. No, that makes sense. Have you guys used, I guess I'm thinking about the single agent nivolumab, but have you guys used the sub-Q formulation at all? Speaking of like a patient, I don't say satisfaction, but a option from a that standpoint.
Yeah, I don't have experience with the sub-Q
Okay.
nivolumab. I don't, and I think there's other sub-Q formulations of other IO therapy, and I don't have experience with that either. What about
Okay. No, that's fair. I'm just curious. We've used it a handful of times, and the patients have been excited because it's just one less amount of time they have to wait in infusion to get something. But sorry, kind of a random question there. What do you think are the biggest side effects when it comes to the immunotherapies that pharmacists should be aware of, and how can we help monitor or manage them, specifically as it relates to the checkpoint inhibitors?
Yeah, so I think it's always something in my head that I'm counseling on. So, you can read the package insert of most of them in the studies where fatigue is common, rash, skin rashes are common. Those are kind of the two big ones that I think of as, likely going to happen or going to happen at some point. But then I also, immunotherapy affects any part of the body. So, that's usually one of the things I tell folks that, you know what, if something persists that you're not used to and you can't explain, the clinic team needs to hear about it because I don't want a patient to sit at home for 3 to 4 weeks saying, I don't know if this diarrhea is because I had something that didn't go well with my food the other night or if it's my immunotherapy. So I think, caution patients about diarrhea, shortness of breath changes, muscle aches and pains that don't go away. A lot of the other things we're going to check on labs when they come in and see kidney, liver, thyroid, other changes. But I think highlighting those things, being aware in a clinic as patients are coming through to go to treatment, keeping an eye on those trends.
Yeah, no,
Kind
I always
of
tell patients, I'm always like, if it's something new that's more than just mild, you need to let us know because it very well could be related. It might not, but I would rather you tell us. And that way we can try to troubleshoot. Like, is this related to your treatment? Is it not? Do we need to make any modifications? Because you're right, I don't want them being miserable. And especially like in the metastatic setting, remember our goals of therapy, right? It's quality of life, it's prolonging life. So I don't want them to be on something that's making them miserable for, the duration of whatever time they have left. So, I try to stress that with them as well. Like, you really just have to be very transparent, and again, making sure they have those phone numbers to call. So yeah, that I'm definitely on par with what I hammer into them as well.
Yeah, they're great treatment options that we have for patients, but also not without side effects that they need to be aware of.
Nope, totally.
Yeah. So I think kind of segueing, so we've talked about chemotherapy, we talked about immunotherapy. We've also had antibody drug conjugates or
Oh,
ADCs
so cool.
that
Yes.
have been new for urothelial cancer. I think they've been in other cancers for maybe a little bit before urothelial, but
Sure,
definitely
sure.
newer to bladder cancer. So can you talk about, what these agents are, what their different mechanism of action is,
Yeah,
what that means for
sure.
us?
So I think ADCs are like the coolest things ever. I always tell patients, I think of them as being targeted chemo, right? So this is not just chemo like our CIS or our gem that you put it in your IV and it's going over your entire body. These are specifically drugs. There's kind of a two components to them, or I guess technically three, but you basically have this monoclonal antibody portion. So that's identifying a certain protein that's on the cancer cell. It's linked then to an actual chemo drug. And so when they give it, this drug is being very specific. It's targeting a very specific receptor on the cancer cell. Once it binds, then it releases the chemo only into that cell. So I really try to tell them, I hope that makes sense to you, but it makes sense to me. But really just like a targeted chemo. So being trying to be very select with how that chemotherapy payload is delivered just to the specific cancer cells. So the two biggest ones I think about, I mean, I guess technically three in the urothelial space. I think one is maybe not used quite as frequently. But I think the one that's brought the biggest amount of change to this disease state right now is enfortumab vedotin, or EV. I think a lot of us shorten it too. And this is an antibody drug conjugate that specifically targets Nectin-4. We know that this is expressed on a variety of cells, highly expressed on bladder cancer cells, or bladder cells. So therefore, when they are it is delivered, it's able to deliver then its chemo payload, which is MMAE, so monomethyl auristatin E. MMAE is much easier to say. And we know that this is a microtubule inhibitor, so acting like a standard cytotoxic chemo, in order to cause that apoptosis of those cells. The other antibody drug conjugate I think about in this space is that actually kind of has a pan tumor approval is trastuzumab deruxtecan. I hope I said that right. I feel like I just call it T-DXd is really how most folks think about it. But anyways, that's another one where it is specifically targeting HER2. So it does have this kind of pan tumor agnostic, I guess, approval where those cancers that express are highly express HER2, so 3+ positivity, it can be used in this population. And it is a targeting the HER2, so that's your antibody, and it's attached to that deruxtecan chemotherapy agent, and that is a topoisomerase 1 inhibitor. So again, very similar in the sense of it's causing that and how it causes that cellular apoptosis, like some of the other standard chemo. And then the third drug, I think it technically is not approved. It just got that approval withdrawn, but I think it is still used in some guidelines, and some providers would say they'd be willing to use it, is the use of sacituzumab govitecan. And so that is targeting that TROP2, and then it is attached to that govitecan payload or that chemo. And again, I think that is also more of a topoisomerase inhibitor, if memory serves. I haven't used that in a while. But yeah, so those are kind of the two major, I guess, antibody drug conjugates that we see the most. Enfortumab is by far used like water, I feel like, in this space right now. And then we also have that option to use that T-DXd as well, for patients that overexpress HER2. So Megan, speaking of EV, how do you think enfortumab plus immunotherapy is being positioned in some of the treatment options for patients with bladder cancer?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, enfortumab plus immunotherapy has kind of revolutionized how metastatic bladder cancer has been treated.
Didn't it get like a standing ovation at the ASCO
That's what
presentation,
I've
if I remember
heard.
right?
I don't know
Yes.
officially, but like what I do remember when was it the ESMO meeting when it or
Yeah, I think.
ASCO, one of I forget which
One of the
one.
two. Now I can't remember. Either way, it was like received
Either.
with like bonkers because the data was phenomenal, which you're going to tell me about.
Yeah, so I mean, that is kind of the leading thing that I remember because you always, as an oncology pharmacist, I think you remember I heard there was a standing ovation when this result was presented at ASCO or ESMO, and I think pembrolizumab and enfortumab was that for bladder cancer. So what they looked at. So let's set the stage for the study. So we've talked about chemotherapy, immunotherapy, and ADCs. There is a study that is called EV-302. I don't always remember the names of the studies, but this one I do, because it compared. I mean, it's not really a remembering kind of name, but EV-302 looked at pembrolizumab and EV combined in a dosing schedule every 3 weeks compared to chemotherapy, first line metastatic urothelial cancer patients. Kind of the big initial start was, well, they categorize them cisplatin ineligible or platinum ineligible or platinum eligible. So it kind of got its first feet into the game when it was found to be effective for those who couldn't get chemotherapy. So the chemo ineligible folks, this showed benefit. We'll fast forward to the meeting where everyone stood up and
So that earlier data was just the phase one or two, right? That was an
I
earlier
think.
phase, small patient population, but it was showed there was some activity there
It
with that
showed
combo.
activity. And I
Okay.
think it kind of led to the initial, like, well, you can start to use it in people who are cisplatin ineligible, which led to that discussion of what makes someone ineligible. But then moving forward, they realized, well, it has activity no matter what, ineligible or not. It doesn't matter. There's no difference in the subgroups. You know, the initial data when they presented it comparing to chemotherapy showed, I had to think of these numbers, but the PFS and OS were like nearly double of each other. So no wonder everyone stood and applauded. Yeah. So people who were getting, 6 months on chemotherapy, suddenly in this combination could get a progression-free survival of 12 months. Fast forward, and we keep looking at the data, and it keeps sustaining and almost even getting better, that no matter what a patient needed, if they needed cisplatin eligible or not, there was still a response. The complete overall response rate was 67.5% for that combination, which is something we haven't seen in bladder cancer in years, decades. I mean, in my lifetime, I don't think I've seen that. So, I mean, in comparing that to 44% of chemo, so chemo is still effective. So I don't mean to knock chemo, but EV plus pembro kind of just knocked it out of the park to say this is the first line treatment option. If a patient is eligible for it, this should be the treatment option. Because I think even the one thing we've talked about is side effects. So, EV plus pembro does have side effects that we want to think about, but numbers wise, it wasn't any worse technically than chemotherapy, just different. I think that's the
No, that's
difference.
true. That's true. That's true.
So, I guess leading into that, talking about side effects, what do you
Yes.
think the main adverse effects that pharmacists can help identify and keep people aware of for this combination?
Yeah, definitely. So I think when I think about EV Pembro, and when I talk to patients about this, and what was seen in the studies is literally what I talk to them about. I think the most common side effect that was seen in EV-302 was that rash or itching. That was nearly 70% of patients, and that was all grades, right? And peripheral neuropathy was the other big thing that happened. And over again, nearly so 67% of patients experienced some grade of peripheral neuropathy. And then fatigue, over, about 50% of patients of all grades experienced fatigue associated with this combination. So, I think just being very honest with them, saying, these things are likely going to happen. The best thing I can have you do, so from a rash perspective, I will say, hey, I need you to, what can we do to prophylax? In my mind, if there's something we can do to prevent the toxicity, I am all about that, especially when it's fairly easy, right? So usually if I'm counseling someone, I'm like, hey, do me a favor. I was like, we're going to be starting this in the week or two, whenever you get scheduled. Until then, I need you to start moisturizing your skin or using emollient creams, moisturizing creams to keep your skin moisturized. If you're down here in the South like I am, you're going to be out in the sun. You better have some sunscreen on because I don't want your skin getting dried out and really putting, like, predisposing you or putting you at risk for experiencing that particular skin toxicity. From a neuropathy standpoint, not a lot to prevent per se, but I think really looking, asking, I will ask folks, hey, this can cause numbness and tingling. I was like, do you have any of that now? Because if the answer is yes, it's really having a good understanding of what is that now and what are we going to be looking out for as we continue on this treatment? Are we making it worse? Is it staying the same? Do we need to do any interventions to help manage that neuropathy? From fatigue, just talking about, making sure that folks are still able to take care of themselves. What is the level of activity now? And again, as a first-line treatment option, I hope folks are still pretty robust. They have been beaten down a lot. Their disease hopefully hasn't progressed exponentially. So I really hope that they have a decent performance status to begin with. But again, letting them know, hey, if this starts becoming a problem and you can't shower or you can't walk to the mailbox or you can't do things on your own, those are things we really need to know about because that's obviously going to have a huge impact, not only on you, but then your family and your caregivers. And we're potentially doing more harm than good with these particular treatments. The other thing too, I do caution folks, you can see a bit of dry eye or some eye changes. So I will tell them, hey, let us know if you start getting blurry vision. Again, prophylaxis wise, using some just wetting drops 3 or 4 times a day to help prevent that from happening is ideal. But again, I need you to let us know if that vision is changing. I think one of the funniest things I've had a patient tell me once, they're like, yeah, I'm having problems seeing. And then the wife looks over, she goes, well, you're not wearing your glasses. And I'm like, well, okay, I need you to put on your glasses and then tell me, can you still see or not? Like, what is the problem here? So again, asking those questions, if they're reporting these things, like, do you baseline wear contacts or have glasses you should be wearing? So it's always good to understand your baseline and then what can we do moving forward. I think what's also hard is that there's a number of these side effects that overlap, right? So you mentioned some of the ones with the immune therapies earlier on. So again, some of that rash or GI toxicity, these are the same things we can see when you add EV into it. But I think some of the biggest, as a pharmacist, you know, because I get these calls routed to me all the time from my nurse, like, hey, they're reporting a rash. Like, what do we do? Or, and it's in between cycles, right? So you're seeing them, whether it's, you know, 1 in 8, they're getting treatment of a 21-day cycle. So maybe it's in that off week, you know, in between visits, and they're calling like, hey, what's going on? And so usually when I call the patient, it's a matter of like, okay, when did it start? If it's within that first cycle, there is a solid chance that's probably more related to EV than it is the actual checkpoint inhibitor. Because those, you know, the median onset of rash in the EV Pembro study was up to just about a month or 1.7 cycles. So some of them as early on as within that very first cycle of treatment. So really thinking about, you know, when is the onset of the toxicity? You know, is holding the drug, does that make it better? So if say somebody comes in and say, yeah, this rash is happening, you know, okay, well, let's just hold the treatment for that particular day, reevaluate their next day of treatment. Well, did it get better or worse? Well, if it's getting better and if they've then had a couple of weeks off of, say, enfortumab, I think it's kind of telling us that it's probably related to the enfortumab, not the checkpoint inhibitor. You know, if it's only getting worse, I think that's, again, more of an immune-mediated toxicity because more time away from something from an EV standpoint, it usually gets better. Whereas from a checkpoint inhibitor, it's either going to stay the same or worsen, even if they've been off treatment. So I think really looking at the timing of the toxicity is huge, and then just holding drug help or not. And then when in doubt, throw a little bit of steroids at it. If it gets better real quick, hey, that's probably related to the checkpoint inhibitor. And then obviously you do want to limit the amount of steroids you're introducing somebody, you know, the lowest effective dose, get it tapered off as quickly as you can, safely, obviously. But I think that's another kind of a way to determine, you know, if you're still not sure what's going on, throw a little bit of steroid at it. You know, it doesn't have to be the whole 2 per kilo per day or something, but this could very well be a low dose, 0.5 or 0.25 per kilo, just to see if that makes that difference. And then I think that can help. I think the other thing that comes up a lot, and I don't know if you see this too, they ask, well, I don't know, do I hold the drug or do I dose adjust it? I think that's always a big, big discussion. And I don't know that we have great data yet. I don't, or maybe you know something I don't. But I feel like, you know, part of it could also be patient preference. I know that might sound a little bit silly, but with the EV Pembro, your EV is days 1 and 8. So 2 weeks in a row, your Pembro is day 1, and that's a 21-day cycle. So if there are having an ongoing problem, you know, one thing that we've utilized, because we are a huge referral center, we're like one of the only academic institutions in South Carolina. So patients are driving hours each time they come in, you know, easy maneuver is just to maybe drop that day 8. And so they're really only getting treatment once every 3 weeks. That, you know, can be beneficial. Or if patients are like, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. I want to make sure I'm on the same schedule. You know, it's not unreasonable to drop the EV from that 1.25 to that 1 milligram per kilo to see if that little bit of an adjustment does help, or even just spacing out the length of the cycle. I think there really are a variety of ways that you can manipulate this particular treatment regimen to make it so it is sustainable for the patient long term. A little bit long-winded out there. What, I don't know. What do you think? What are things that you see?
Yeah. I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head about, you know, there's not really a cookbook. Here's how I should adjust. Should I hold a day? Should I dose reduce? Mm-hmm. I think we're still figuring that out. Mm-hmm. You can follow the protocol and buy the book, what they did in the protocol. But I think it involves that discussion with the patient and what makes them feel a little bit less nervous if we have to adjust or hold, because I mean, they still want to maintain dose intensity. They still want to keep on treatment. I think the interesting thing too, that you talked about, you know, rash and that overlapping, because I think that's the unique overlap, right? Fatigue overlaps. So you can hold and adjust if it's that debilitating, but the rash is interesting because I think it also timing wise is different, but I think it also location wise is different.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true. And I didn't even bring that up, but you're absolutely correct.
And the feel of it, or the feel, I guess the feel of it, for lack of a better word. But yeah, like, I've heard the description and read about it that it feels like a sunburn almost if it is the enfortumab, whether that's the scientific answer or not. But like, that's the, you know, if I'm distinguishing it, that's something I would be concerned about. If it's a redness and it hurts, it might be more concerning versus that maculopapular rash anywhere.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. Yeah. I know we're running out a little bit of time here, but wrap it up. Like, the role of the pharmacist, you know, as it's evolving here in the future, when it comes to managing these patients, what do you think is going to be different now versus prior?
Oh man. I think, I mean, if these treatments keep evolving, I think it's only going to continue to grow. I mean, I think it's going to be a continued evolution of helping teams and patients navigate where are the side effects coming from. As these treatment options are looked at in different settings, that's going to change, the management of patients and how involved a pharmacist can be. So I think, we've talked a lot about metastatic disease, but as you know, these things keep moving up. As with any solid tumor cancer, we move things up in therapy and move them up in line. So if these regimens become more prevalent across the board in bladder cancer for all stages or more stages, I think helping evolve and manage those side effects for patients and providers will be key. And who knows, there might be other treatments coming down the pipe that might have more side effects we need to help distinguish or manage. And I mean, we didn't even really touch on some of the other targeted agents that are approved and
Yeah,
need
that's
pharmacist
true. Not enough
support.
time.
So
Not enough time.
we could talk about this for days. But I mean, I think the role, I think, has evolved even in the decade I've been doing this, that we're helping manage patients more and more and distinguish these things and kind of, I think, emphasize. I think it's another point of emphasis that, if a patient notices something, we want them to say something about the side effects so they're not miserable at home.
Yeah,
So
definitely.
I think that's where I see it going.
Awesome. Totally agree.
So I think with that, as you pointed out, we've talked a lot about bladder cancer a bit. So thank you, Sherry, for an excellent discussion. I'd also like to thank the viewing audience and hope that you guys found this Pharmacy Times Medcast educational. So have a great day.